Chapter 35. A Parting of Ways. The weather held fair, which meant that the wagons rolled into Imre just as the sun was setting. My mood was sullen and hurt. Denna had shared a wagon with Jossen the whole of the day, and I, being foolish and proud, had kept my distance. A whirl of activity sprang up as soon as the wagons rolled to a stop. Rowent began to argue with a clean-shaven man in a velvet hat before he had brought his wagon to a full stop. After the initial bout of bargaining, a dozen men began unloading bolts of cloth, barrels of molasses, and burlap sacks of coffee. Rita cast a stern eye over the lot of them. Jossen scuttled around, trying to keep his luggage from being damaged or stolen. My own luggage was easier to manage, as I only had my travel sack. I retrieved it from between some bolts of cloth and moved away from the wagons. I slung it over one shoulder and looked around for Denna. I found Rita instead. "You're a great help on the road," she said clearly. Her Aeturin was much better than Rowan's, with hardly any trace of Ciaro accent at all. "It is nice to have someone along who can unhitch a horse without being led by the hand." She held out a coin to me. I took it without thinking. It was a reflex action from my years as a beggar, like the reverse of jerking your hand back from a fire. Only after the coin was in my hand did I take a closer look at it. It was a whole copper jot, fully half of what I had paid to travel with them to Imre. When I looked back up, Rita was heading back toward the wagons. Not sure what to think, I wandered over to where Derek sat on the edge of a horse trough. He shaded his eyes against the evening sun with one hand as he looked up at me. "On your way, then? I almost thought you might stick with us for a while." I shook my head. "Rita just gave me a jot." He nodded. "I'm not terribly surprised. Most folks are nothing but dead weight," he shrugged. "And she appreciated your playing. Have you ever thought of trying out as a minstrel? They say Imre's a good place for it." I steered the conversation back to Rita. "I don't want Rowan to be angry with her. He seems to take his money pretty seriously." Derek laughed. "And she doesn't?" "I gave my money to Rowan," I clarified. "If he wanted to give some of it back, I think he'd do it himself." Derek nodded. "It's not their way. A man doesn't give money away." "That's my point," I said. "I don't want her to get in trouble." Derek waved his hands back and forth, cutting me off. "I'm not doing a good job of explaining myself," he said. "Rowent knows. He might have even sent her over to do it. But grown Sealdish men don't give away money. It's seen as womanish behavior. They don't even buy things if they can help it. Didn't you notice that Rita was the one who bargained for our rooms and food at the inn a few nights ago?" I did remember, now that he mentioned it. "But why?" I asked. Derek shrugged. "There isn't any why. It's just the way they do things. That's why so many Sealdish caravans are husband-wife teams."
"Derek!"
Rowan's voice came from behind the wagons. He sighed as he stood up. "Duty calls," he said. "See you around." I tucked the jot into my pocket and thought about what Derek had said. The truth was, my troop had never gone so far north as to make it into the Shald. It was unnerving to think I wasn't as world-wise as I'd thought. I slung my travel sack over my shoulder and looked around one last time, thinking that perhaps it would be best if I left without any troublesome goodbyes. Denna was nowhere to be seen. That settled it, then. I turned to leave and found her standing behind me. She smiled a little awkwardly with her hands clasped behind her back. She was lovely as a flower and totally unconscious of it. I was suddenly short of breath, and I forgot myself, my irritation, my hurt. "You're still going?" she asked. I nodded. "You could come to Annalyn with us," she suggested. "They say the streets are paved with gold there. You could teach Jossen to play that lute he carries around," she smiled. "I've asked him. He said he wouldn't mind." I considered it. For half a heartbeat, I almost threw my whole plan aside just to stay with her a little longer. But the moment passed, and I shook my head. "Don't look like that," she chided me with a smile. "I'll be there for a while. If things don't work out for you here..." She trailed off hopefully. I didn't know what I could do if things didn't work out for me here. I was hanging all my hopes on the university. Besides, Annalyn was hundreds of miles away. I barely owned the clothes on my back. How would I find her? Denna must have seen my thoughts reflected on my face. She smiled playfully. "I guess I'll just have to come looking for you, then." We rue are travelers. Our lives are composed of meetings and partings, with brief, bright acquaintances in between. Because of this, I knew the truth. I felt it, heavy and certain in the pit of my stomach. I would never see her again. Before I could say anything, she looked nervously behind her. "I had better go. Watch for me." She flashed her impish smile again before turning to walk away. "I will," I called after her. "I'll see you where the roads meet." She glanced back and hesitated for a moment, then waved and ran off into the early evening twilight. Chapter 36. Less Talents. I spent the night sleeping outside the city limits of Imre in a soft bed of heather. The next day, I woke late, washed in a nearby stream, and made my way west to the university. As I walked, I watched the horizon for the largest building in the university. From Ben's descriptions, I knew what it would look like. Featureless, gray, and square as a block. Larger than four granaries stacked together. No windows, no decorations, and only one set of great stone doors. 10 times 10,000 books. The archives. I had come to the university for many reasons, but that was at the heart of it. The archives held answers, and I had many, many questions. First and foremost, I wanted to know the truth about the Chandrian and the Aemir. I needed to know how much of Scarpi's story was the truth. When the road crossed the Omethi River, there was an old stone bridge. I don't doubt that you know the type. It was one of those ancient, mammoth pieces of architecture scattered throughout the world, so old and solidly built that they have become part of the landscape, not a soul wondering who built them or why. This one was particularly impressive. Over 200 feet long and wide enough for two wagons to pass each other, it stretched over the canyon the Omethi had carved into the rock. When I reached the crest of the bridge, I saw the archives for the first time in my life, rising like some great graystone over the trees to the west. The university lay at the heart of a small city, though truthfully, I hesitate to call it a city at all. It was nothing like Tarbian, with its twisting alleys and garbage smell. It was more of a town, with wide roads and clean air. Lawns and gardens were spaced between small houses and shops. But since this town had grown up to serve the peculiar needs of the university, a careful observer could note small differences in the services the town provided. For instance, there were 2 glassblowers, 3 fully stocked apothecaries, 2 binderies, 4 booksellers, 2 brothels, and a truly disproportionate number of taverns. One of them had a large wooden sign nailed to its door proclaiming, "No sympathy." I wondered what non-arcane visitors might think of the warning. The university itself consisted of about 15 buildings that bore little resemblance to each other. Mews had a circular central hub with 8 wings radiating in each direction so it looked like a compass rose. Hollows was simple and square, with stained glass windows showing Tekum in a classic pose, standing barefoot in the mouth of his cave, speaking to a group of students. Mains was the most distinctive building of the lot. It covered nearly 1.5 acres and looked like it had been cobbled together from a number of smaller, mismatched buildings. As I approached the archives, its gray, windowless surface reminded me of an immense graystone. It was hard to believe, after all the years of waiting, that I was finally there. I circled around it until I found the entrance, a massive pair of stone doors standing wide open. Over them, chiseled deep into the stone, were the words Vorfelin Renata More. I didn't recognize the language. It wasn't Siaru, maybe Yilish or Temek. Yet another question I needed answers for. Through the stone doors were a small antechamber with a more ordinary set of wooden doors inside. I tugged them open and felt cool, dry air brush past me. The walls were bare gray stone, lit with a distinctive, unwavering reddish light of sympathy lamps. There was a large wooden desk with several large ledger-type books lying open atop it. At the desk sat a young man who looked to be a full-blooded Sealed, with the characteristic ruddy complexion and dark hair and eyes.
"Can I help you?"
he asked, his voice thick with the harsh burr a Sierra accent makes.
"I'm here for the archives," I said stupidly. My stomach was dancing with butterflies. My palms were sweaty.
He looked me over, obviously wondering at my age.
"Are you a student?"
"Soon," I said. "I haven't been through admissions yet."
"You'll need to do that first,"
he said seriously.
"I can't let anyone in unless they're in the book."
He gestured at the ledgers on the desk in front of him. The butterflies died. I didn't bother to hide my disappointment.
"Are you sure I can't look around just for a couple of minutes? I've come an awfully long way."
I looked at the two sets of double doors leading out of the room, one labeled Tomes, the other Stacks. Behind the desk, a smaller door was labeled Scrivs Only. His expression softened somewhat.
"I cannot. There would be trouble."
He looked me over again.
"Are you really going through admissions?"
His skepticism was obvious, even through his thick accent. I nodded.
"I just came here first,"
I said, looking around the empty room, eyeing the closed doors, trying to think of some way to persuade him to let me in. He spoke before I could think of anything.
"If you're really going, you should hurry. Today is the last day. Sometimes they don't go much longer than noon."
My heart beat hard and quick in my chest. I'd assumed they would run all day.
"Where are they?"
"Hollows." He gestured toward the outer door.
"Down, then left. Short building with color windows. Two big trees out front."
He paused.
"Maple? Is that the word for a tree?"
I nodded and hurried outside. Soon, I was pelting down the road. 2 hours later, I was in Hollows, fighting down a sour stomach and climbing up onto the stage of an empty theater. The room was dark, except for the wide circle of light that held the master's table. I walked to stand at the edge of the light and waited. Slowly, the nine masters stopped talking among themselves and turned to look at me. They sat at a huge, crescent-shaped table. It was raised, so even seated, they were looking down on me. They were serious-looking men, ranging in age from mature to ancient. There was a long moment of silence before the man sitting at the center of the crescent motioned me forward. I guessed he was the Chancellor.
"Come up where we can see you."
"That's right."
"Hello. Now, what's your name, boy?"
"Kvothe, sir."
"And why are you here?"
I looked him in the eye. "I want to attend the university. I want to be an arcanist." I looked around at each of them. Some seemed amused. None looked particularly surprised.
"You are aware," the Chancellor said, "that the university is for continuing one's education, not beginning it?"
"Yes, Chancellor, I know."
"Very well," he said. May I have your letter of introduction?
I didn't hesitate. I'm afraid I don't have one, sir. Is it absolutely necessary?
It is customary to have a sponsor, he explained. Preferably an arcanist. Their letter tells us what you know, your areas of excellence and weakness.
The arcanist I learned from was named Abanthi, sir, but he never gave me a letter of introduction. Might I tell you myself?
The Chancellor nodded gravely. Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing that you actually have studied with an arcanist without proof of some kind. Do you have anything that can corroborate your story? Any other correspondence?
He gave me a book before we parted ways, sir. He inscribed it to me and signed his name.
The Chancellor smiled. That should do nicely. Do you have it with you?
No.
I let some honest bitterness creep into my voice. I had to pawn it in Tarbian.
Sitting to the left of the Chancellor, Master Rhetorician Hem made a disgusted noise at my comment, earning him an irritated look from the Chancellor.
Come, Herma, Hem said, slapping his hand on the table. The boy is obviously lying. I have important matters to attend to this afternoon.
The Chancellor gave him a vastly irritated look.
I have not given you leave to speak, Master Hem.
The two of them stared at each other for a long moment before Hem looked away, scowling. The Chancellor turned back to me, then his eye caught some movement from one of the other masters.
Yes, Master Lauren?
The tall, thin master looked at me passively.
What was the book called?
Rhetoric and Logic, sir.
And where did you pawn it?
The Broken Binding on Seward Square. Lauren turned to look at the Chancellor.
I will be leaving for Tarbian tomorrow to fetch necessary materials for the upcoming term. If it is there, I will bring it back. The matter of the boy's claim can be settled then.
The Chancellor gave a small nod.
Thank you, Master Lauren.
He settled himself back into his chair and folded his hands in front of himself.
Very well, then. What would Abanthi's letter tell us if he had written it?
I took a good breath. He would say that I knew by heart the first 90 sympathetic bindings, that I could double distill, perform tritations, calcify, sublimate, and precipitate solution, that I am well versed in history, argument, grammars, medicine, and geometry.
The Chancellor did his best to not look amused.
That's quite a list. Are you sure you didn't leave anything out?
I paused. He probably would have also mentioned my age, sir.
How old are you, boy?
Quoth, sir.
A smile tugged at the Chancellor's face.
Quoth.
15, sir.
There was a rustle as the masters each took some small action, exchanged glances, raised eyebrows, shook their heads. Hem rolled his eyes skyward. Only the Chancellor did nothing.
How exactly would he have mentioned your age?
I gave a thin sliver of a smile. He would have urged you to ignore it. There was a breath of silence. The Chancellor drew a deep breath and leaned back in his seat.
Very well. We have a few questions for you. Would you like to begin, Master Brandur?
He made a gesture toward one end of the crescent table. I turned to face Brandur. Portly and balding, he was the university's master arithmetician.
How many grains are in 13 ounces?
6,240, I said immediately. He raised his eyebrows a little.
If I had 50 silver talents and converted them to vintage coin and back, how much would I have if the sealdom took 4% each time?
I started the ponderous conversion between currencies, then smiled as I realized it was unnecessary.
46 talents and 8 drabs, if he's honest. 46 even, if he's not.
He nodded again, looking at me more closely.
"You have a triangle," he said slowly. "One side is 7 feet, another side 3 feet. One angle is 60 degrees. How long is the other side?"
"Is the angle between the two sides?" He nodded. I closed my eyes for the space of half a breath, then opened them again.
6 feet and 6 inches, dead even.
He made a humph noise and looked surprised.
"Good enough. Master Arwill?"
Arwill had asked his question before I had time to turn and to face him.
"What are the medicinal properties of hellebore?"
"Anti-inflammatory, antiseptic, mild sedative, mild analgesic, blood purifier," I said, looking up at the grandfatherly spectacle old man. "Toxic if used excessively, dangerous for women who are with child."
"Name the component structures that comprise the hand."
I named all 27 bones alphabetically, then the muscles from largest to smallest. I listed them quickly, matter-of-factly, pointing out their locations on my own upraised hand. The speed and accuracy of my answers impressed them. Some of them hid it. Others wore it openly on their faces. The truth was, I needed to impress them. I knew from my previous discussions with Ben that you needed money or brains to get into the university. The more of one you had, the less of the other you needed. So I was cheating. I had snuck into Hollows through a back entrance, acting the part of an errand boy. Then I picked two locks and spent more than an hour watching other students' interviews. I heard hundreds of questions and thousands of answers. I also heard how high the other students' tuitions were set. The lowest had been 4 talents and 6 jots, but most were double that. One student had been charged over 30 talents for his tuition. It would have been easier for me to get a piece of the moon than that much money. I had 2 copper jots in my pocket and no way to get a bent penny more, so I needed to impress them. More than that, I needed to confound them with my intelligence, to dazzle them. I finished listing the muscles of the hand and started in on the ligatures when Arwill waved me into silence and asked his next question.
"When do you bleed a patient?"
The question brought me up short.
"When I want him to die?" I asked dubiously.
He nodded, mostly to himself.
"Master Lauren?"
Master Lauren was pale and seemed unnaturally tall even while sitting.
"Who was the first declared king of Tarvintus?"
"Posthumously, Feda Calanthus. Otherwise, it would be his brother, Jarvis."
"Why did the Aeturan Empire collapse?"
I paused, taken aback by the scope of the question. None of the other students had been asked anything so broad as this.
"Well, sir," I said slowly to give myself a moment or two to organize my thoughts, "partly because Lord Nalto was an inept egomaniac, partly because the church went into upheaval and denounced the Order Aemir, who were a large part of the strength of Aetur, partly because the military was fighting 3 different wars of conquest at the same time, and high taxes fomented rebellion in lands already inside the Empire."
I watched the Master's expression, hoping he would give some sign when he had heard enough.
"They also debased their currency, undercut the universality of the Iron Law, and antagonized the Aedim."
I shrugged. "But of course, it's more complicated than that." Master Lauren's expression remained unchanged, but he nodded.
"Who was the greatest man who ever lived?"
Another unfamiliar question. I thought for a moment. "Ilion." Master Lauren blinked once, expressionless.
"Master Mandrag?"
Mandrag was clean-shaven and smooth-faced, with hands stained 600 different colors and seemed to be made all of knuckle and bone.
"If you need phosphorus, where would you get it?"
His tone sounded for a moment so much like Abinthy's that I forgot myself and spoke without thinking.
An apothecary?
One of the masters on the other side of the table chuckled, and I bit my too quick tongue. He gave me a faint smile, and I drew a faint breath.
Barring access to an apothecary.
I could render it from urine, I said quickly, given a kiln and enough time.
How much would you need to gain 2 ounces pure?
He cracked his knuckles absent-mindedly. I paused to consider, as this was a new question, too. At least 40 gallons, Master Mandrag, depending on the quality of the material. There was a long pause as he cracked his knuckles one at a time.
What are the 3 most important rules of the chemist?
This I knew from Ben. Label clearly, measure twice, eat elsewhere. He nodded, still wearing the faint smile.
Master Kilvin?
Kilvin was Sealdish. His thick shoulders and bristling black beard reminded me of a bear.
Right,
he grumbled, folding his thick hands in front of him.
How would you make an ever-burning lamp?
Each of the other 8 masters made some sort of exasperated noise or gesture.
What?
Kilvin demanded, looking around at them irritated.
It is my question. The asking is mine.
He turned his attention back to me.
So, how would you make it?
Well, I said slowly, I would probably start with a pendulum of some sort. Then I would bind it to...
Cram! No, not like this!
Kilvin growled out a couple of words and pounded his fist on the table. Each thump as his hand came down was accompanied by a staccato burst of reddish light that welled up from his hand.
No sympathy! I don't want an ever-glowing lamp. I want an ever-burning one.
He looked at me again, showing his teeth, as if he were going to eat me.
Lithium salt?
I asked without thinking, then backpedaled. No, a sodium oil that burned in an enclosed...
No, damn!
I mumbled my way to a stop. The other applicants hadn't had to deal with questions like these. He cut me off with a short sideways gesture of his hand.
Enough! We will talk later. Elxadal!
It took me a moment to remember that Elxadal was the next master. I turned to him. He looked like the archetypal sinister magician that seems to be a requirement in so many bad Aeturan plays. Severe dark eyes, lean face, short black beard. For all that, his expression was friendly enough.
What are the words for the first parallel kinetic binding?
I rattled them off glibly. He didn't seem surprised.
What was the binding that Master Kilvin used just a moment ago?
Capacitorial kinetic luminosity.
What is the synodic period?
I looked at him oddly. Of the moon? The question seemed a little out of sync with the other two. He nodded.
72 1/3 days, sir, give or take a bit.
He shrugged and gave a wry smile, as if he'd expected to catch me with the last question.
Master Hem?
Hem looked at me over steepled fingers.
How much mercury would it take to reduce 2 gills of white sulfur?
He asked pompously, as if I'd already given the wrong answer. One of the things I learned during my hour of quiet observation was this. Master Hem was the king high bastard of the lot. He took delight in students' discomfort and did everything he could to badger and unsettle them. He had a fondness for trick questions. Luckily, this was one I had watched him use on other students. You see, you can't reduce white sulfur with mercury.
Well,
I drew the word out, pretending to think it through. Hem's smug smile grew wider by the second.
Assuming you mean red sulfur, it would be about 41 ounces.
Sir, I smiled a sharp smile at him, all teeth.
Name the 9 prime fallacies,
he snapped.
Simplification, generalization,
circularity, reduction, analogy, false causality, semantism, irrelevancy.
I paused, not being able to remember the formal name of the last one. Ben and I had called it Nalt, after Emperor Nalto. It galled me, not being able to recall its name, as I had read it in Rhetoric and Logic just a few days ago. My irritation must have shown on my face. Hem glowered at me as I paused, saying, "So, you don't know everything after all." He leaned back into his seat with a satisfied expression. "I wouldn't be here if I didn't think I had anything to learn," I said bitingly before I managed to get my tongue under control again. From the other side of the table, Kilvin gave a deep chuckle. Hem opened his mouth, but the Chancellor silenced him with a look before he could say anything else.
"Now then," the Chancellor began, "I think I, too, would ask some questions."
The man to the Chancellor's right said. He had an accent that I couldn't quite place. Or perhaps it was that his voice held a certain resonance. When he spoke, everyone at the desk stirred slightly, then grew still, like leaves touched by the wind.
"Master Namer," the Chancellor said with equal parts deference and trepidation.
Illodin was younger than the others by at least a dozen years, clean-shaven with deep eyes, medium height, medium build. There was nothing particularly striking about him, except for the way he sat at the table. One moment watching something intently, the next minute, bored and letting his attention wander among the high beams of the ceiling above. He was almost like a child who had been forced to sit down with adults. I felt Master Illodin look at me. Actually felt it. I suppressed a shiver.
"So heketh ka siaro kremeteth tu?"
he asked.
"How well do you speak siaro?"
"Reusa, takreala deala tu."
"Not very well, thank you." He lifted a hand, his index finger pointed upward. "How many fingers am I holding up?" I paused for a moment, which was more consideration than the question seemed to warrant.
"At least one," I said. "Probably no more than six."
He broke into a broad smile and brought his other hand up from underneath the table. It had two fingers upright. He waved them back and forth for the other masters to see, nodding his head from side to side in an absent, childish way. Then he lowered his hands to the table in front of him and grew suddenly serious.
"Do you know the seven words that will make a woman love you?"
I looked at him, trying to decide if there was more to the question. When nothing more was forthcoming, I answered simply, "No."
"They exist,"
he reassured me, and sat back with a look of contentment.
"Master Linguist?"
He nodded to the Chancellor.
"That seems to cover most of academia," the Chancellor said, almost to himself.
I had the impression that something had unsettled him, but he was too composed for me to tell exactly what.
"You will forgive me if I ask a few things of a less scholarly nature?"
Having no real choice, I nodded. He gave me a long look that seemed to stretch several minutes.
"Why didn't Abinthes send a letter of recommendation with you?"
I hesitated. Not all traveling entertainers are as respectable as our troupe, so, understandably, not everyone respected them. But I doubted that lying was the best course of action. "He left my troupe 3 years ago. I haven't seen him since." I saw each of the masters look at me. I could almost hear them doing the mental arithmetic, calculating my age backward.
"Oh, come now!"
Hem said disgustedly, and moved as if he would stand. The Chancellor gave him a dark look, silencing him.
"Why do you wish to attend the university?"
I stood dumbfounded. It was the one question I was completely unprepared for. What could I say? 10,000 books? Your archives? I used to have dreams of reading there when I was young. True, but too childish.
I want revenge against the Chandrian.
Too dramatic.
To become so powerful that no one will ever be able to hurt me again.
Too frightening.
I looked up to the Chancellor and realized I'd been quiet for a long while. Unable to think of anything else, I shrugged and said, I don't know, sir. I guess I'll have to learn that, too. The Chancellor's eyes had taken on a curious look by this point, but he pushed it aside and said,
Is there anything else you would like to say?
He had asked the question of the other applicants, but none of them had taken advantage of it. It seemed almost rhetorical, a ritual before the masters discussed the applicant's tuition. Yes, please, I said, surprising him. I have a favor to ask beyond mere admission. I took a deep breath, letting their attention settle on me. It has taken me nearly 3 years to get here. I may seem young, but I belong here as much, if not more, than some rich lordling who can't tell salt from cyanide by tasting it. I paused. However, at this moment I have 2 jots in my purse and nowhere in the world to get more than that. I have nothing worth selling that I haven't already sold. Admit me for more than 2 jots, and I will not be able to attend. Admit me for less, and I will be here every day, while every night I will do what it takes to stay alive while I study here. I will sleep in alleys and stables, wash dishes for kitchen scraps, beg pennies to buy pens. I will do whatever it takes. I said the last words fiercely, almost snarling them. But admit me free, and give me 3 talents so I can live and buy what I need to learn properly, and I will be a student the likes of which you have never seen before. There was a half-breath of silence, followed by a thunderclap of a laugh from Kilvin. He roared.
If 1 student in 10 had half his fire, I'd teach with a whip and chair instead of chalk and slate.
He brought his hand down hard on the table in front of him. This sparked everyone to begin talking at the same time in their own varied tones. The Chancellor made a little wave in my direction, and I took the chance to seat myself in the chair that stood at the edge of the circle of light. The discussion seemed to go on for quite a long while, but even 2 or 3 minutes would have seemed like an eternity, sitting there while a group of old men debated my future. There was no actual shouting, but a fair amount of hand-waving, most of it by Master Hem, who seemed to have taken the same dislike of me that I had for him. It wouldn't have been so bad if I could have understood what they were saying, but even my finely tuned eavesdropper's ears couldn't quite make out what was being said. Their talking died down suddenly, and then the Chancellor looked in my direction, motioning me forward.
Let it be recorded, he said formally, that Quoth, son of...
He paused, then looked at me inquiringly. Arladen, I supplied. The name sounded strange to me after all these years. Master Loren turned to look in my direction, blinking once.
Son of Arladen is admitted into the university for the continuance of his education on the 43rd day of Catelan, his admission into the Arcanum contingent upon proof that he has mastered the basic principles of sympathy. Official sponsor being one Kilvin, Master Artificer. His tuition shall be set at the rate of less 3 talents.
I felt a great dark weight settle inside me. 3 talents might as well be all the money in the world for any hope I had in earning it before the term began. Working in kitchens, running errands for pennies, I might be able to save that much in a year if I was lucky. I held a desperate hope that I could cut purse that much in time, but I knew the thought to be just that. Desperate. People with that sort of money generally knew better than to leave it hanging in a purse. I didn't realize that the masters had left the table until one of them approached me. I looked up to see the master archivist approaching me. Loren was taller than I would have guessed, over 6.5 feet. His long face and hands made him look almost stretched. When he saw he had my attention, he asked,
Did you say your father's name was Arladen?
He asked it very calmly, with no hint of regret or apology in his voice. It suddenly made me very angry that he should stifle my ambitions of getting into the university, then come over and ask about my dead father as easy as saying good morning. "Yes," I said tightly. "Arladin the Bard." My father always thought of himself as a trooper. He never called himself bard or minstrel. Hearing him referred to in that way irritated me even more, if that were possible. I didn't deign to reply, merely nodded once, sharply. If he thought my response terse, he didn't show it. I was wondering which troop he performed in. My thin restraint burst. "Oh, you were wondering," I said with every bit of venom my troop-sharpened tongue could muster. "Well, maybe you can wonder a while longer. I'm stuck in ignorance now. I think you can abide a while with a little piece of it yourself. When I come back after earning my 3 talents, maybe then you can ask me again." I gave him a fierce look, as if hoping to burn him with my eyes. His reaction was minimal. It wasn't until later that I found getting any reaction from Master Lauren was about as likely as seeing a stone pillar wink. He looked vaguely puzzled at first, then slightly taken aback. Then, as I glared up at him, he gave a faint, thin smile and mutely handed me a piece of paper. I unfolded it and read it. It read, "Quoth, spring term, tuition, -3 talent. -3 talents. Of course. Relief flooded me. As if it were a great wave that swept my legs from beneath me, I sat suddenly on the floor and wept. Chapter 37. Bright-Eyed. Lauren led the way across a courtyard.
"That is what most of the discussion was about," Master Lauren explained, his voice as passionless as stone. "You had to have a tuition. Everyone does."
I had recovered my composure and apologized for my terrible manners. He nodded calmly and offered to escort me to the office of the bursar to ensure that there was no confusion regarding my admission fee.
"After it was decided to admit you in the manner you had suggested."
Lauren gave a brief but significant pause, leading me to believe that it had not been quite as simple as that.
"There was the problem that there was no precedent set for giving out funds to enrolling students."
He paused again.
"A rather unusual thing."
Lauren led me into another stone building, through a hallway, and down a flight of stairs.
"Hello, Riam."
The bursar was an elderly, irritable man who became more irritable when he discovered that he had to give money to me rather than the other way around. After I got my 3 talents, Master Lauren led me out of the building. I remembered something and dug into my pocket, glad for an excuse to divert the conversation. "I have a receipt from the broken binding." I handed him the piece of paper, wondering what the owner would think when the university's master archivist showed up to redeem the book a filthy street urchin had sold him.
"Master Lauren, I appreciate your agreeing to do this, and I hope you won't think me ungrateful if I ask another favor."
Lauren glanced at the receipt before tucking it into a pocket and looked at me intently. No, not intently, not quizzically. There was no expression on his face at all, no curiosity, no irritation, nothing. If not for the fact that his eyes were focused on me, I would have thought he'd forgotten I was there.
"Feel free to ask," he said.
"That book, it's all I have left from that time in my life. I would very much like to buy it back from you someday, when I have the money." He nodded, still expressionless.
"That can be arranged. Do not waste your worry on its safety. It will be kept as carefully as any book in the archives."
Lauren raised a hand, gesturing to a passing student. A sandy-haired boy pulled up short and approached nervously. Radiating deference, he made a nod that was almost like a bow to the master archivist.
"Yes, Master Lauren."
Lauren gestured to me with one of his long hands.
Simon, this is Quoth. He needs to be shown about, signed to classes and the like. Kilvin wants him in artificing. Trust to your judgment otherwise. Will you tend to it?
Simon nodded again and brushed his hair out of his eyes.
Yes, sir.
Without another word, Lauren turned and walked away, his long strides making his black master's robe billow out behind him. Simon was young for a student, though still a couple years my senior. He stood taller than me, but his face was still boyish, his manner boyishly shy.
Do you have somewhere to stay yet?
He asked as we started to walk.
Room at an inn or anything?
I shook my head.
I just got in today. I haven't thought much further than getting through admissions.
Simon chuckled.
I know what that's like. I still get sweaty at the beginning of each term.
He pointed to the left, down a wide lane lined with trees.
Let's head to Mew's first, then.
I stopped walking.
I don't have a lot of money, I admitted.
I hadn't planned on getting a room. I was used to sleeping outside, and I knew I would need to save my 3 talents for clothes, food, paper, and next term's tuition. I couldn't count on the master's generosity 2 terms in a row.
Admissions didn't go that well, huh?
Simon said sympathetically as he took my elbow and steered me toward another one of the gray university buildings. This one was 3 stories tall, many windowed, and had several wings radiating out from a central hub.
Don't feel bad about it. I got nervous and pissed myself the first time through, figuratively.
I didn't do that badly, I said suddenly, very conscious of the 3 talents in my purse. But I think I offended Master Lauren. He seems a little...
chilly?
Simon asked.
Distant? Like an unblinking pillar of stone?
He laughed. Lauren is always like that. Rumor has it that Elxadal has a standing offer of 10 gold marks to anyone who can make him laugh.
Oh.
I relaxed a little.
That's good.
He's the last person I'd want to get on the wrong side of. I'm looking forward to spending a lot of time in the archives.
Just handle the books gently and you'll get along fine.
He's pretty detached for the most part, but careful around his books. He raised an eyebrow and shook his head.
He's fiercer than a mother bear protecting her cubs. In fact, I'd rather get caught by a mother bear than have Lauren see me folding back a page.
Simon kicked at a rock, sending it skipping down the cobblestones.
Okay. You've got options in the Mews. A talent will get you a bunk and a meal chit for the term.
He shrugged.
Nothing fancy, but it keeps the rain off. You can share a room for 2 talents or get 1 all to yourself for 3.
What's a meal chit?
Meals are 3 a day over in the mess.
He pointed to a long, low-roofed building across the lawn.
The food isn't bad so long as you don't think too hard about where it might have come from.
I did some quick arithmetic. A talent for 2 months' worth of meals and a dry place to sleep was as good a deal as I could hope for. I smiled at Simon.
Sounds like just the thing.
Simon nodded as he opened the door into the Mews.
Bunks it is, then. Come on, let's find a steward and get you signed up.
The bunks for non-Arcanum students were on the 4th floor of the east wing of Mews, farthest from the bathing facilities on the ground floor. The accommodations were as Sim had described, nothing fancy. But the narrow bed had clean sheets, and there was a trunk with a lock where I could keep my meager possessions. All the lower bunks had already been claimed, so I took an upper one in the far corner of the room. As I looked out one of the narrow windows from on top of my bunk, I was reminded of my secret place high on Tarbian's rooftops. The similarity was oddly comforting. Lunch was a bowl of steaming hot potato soup, beans, narrow rashers of fatty bacon, and fresh brown bread. The room's large plank tables were nearly half full, seating about 200 students. The room was full of the low murmur of conversation, punctuated by laughter and the metallic sound of spoons and forks scraping against the tin trays. Simon steered me to the back corner of the long room.
two other students looked up as we approached. Simon made a one-handed gesture to me as he set down his tray. "Everyone, meet Kvothe, our newest dewy-eyed first-termer." He gestured from one person to the next. "Kvothe, these are the worst students the Arcanum has to offer. Manette and Willem."
"Already met him,"
Willem said. He was the dark-haired sealdom from the archives.
"You really were headed to admissions," he said, mildly surprised. "I thought you were dealing me false iron."
He reached out his hand for me to shake.
"Welcome."
"Tailu, anyway,"
Manette muttered, looking over at me. He was at least 50 years old, with wild hair and a grizzled beard. He wore a slightly disheveled look, as if he'd only woken up a few minutes ago.
"Am I as old as I feel, or is he as young as he looks?"
"Both," Simmons said cheerfully as he sat down. "Kvothe, Manette here has been in the Arcanum for longer than all of us put together." Manette snorted.
"Give me some credit. I've been in the Arcanum longer than any of you have been alive."
"And still a lowly Ilir,"
Willem said. His thick Siaru accent made it hard to tell if he was being sarcastic or not.
"Huzzah to being an Ilir," Manette said earnestly. "You boys will regret it if you move any farther up the ranks. Trust me, it's just more hassle and higher tuition."
"We want our guilders, Manette," Simmons said. "Preferably sometime before we're dead."
"The guilder is overrated too," Manette said,
tearing off a piece of bread and dunking it in his soup. The exchange had an easy feel, and I guessed this was a familiar conversation.
"How'd you do?" Simon asked Willem eagerly.
7 and 8,
Willem grumbled. Simon looked surprised. "What in God's name happened? Did you punch one of them?"
"Fumbled my cipher," Willem said sullenly. "And Lauren asked about the influence of subinfeudation on Modegan currency. Kilvin had to translate. Even then, I could not answer."
"My soul weeps for you," Sim said lightly. "You trounced me these last 2 terms. I was bound to catch a break sooner or later. I got 5 talents even this term." He held out his hand. "Pay up." Willem dug into his pocket and handed Sim a copper jot. I looked at Manette. "Aren't you in on it?" The wild-haired man huffed a laugh and shook his head.
"There'd be some long odds against me," he said, his mouth half full.
"Let's hear it," Simon said with a sigh. "How much this term?"
1 and 6,
Manette said, grinning like a wolf. Before anyone could think to ask me what my tuition was, I spoke up. "I heard about someone getting a 30-talent tuition. Do they usually get that high?"
"Not if you have the good sense to stay low in the rankings," Manette grumbled.
"Only nobility," Willem said.
"Crimelish bastards with no business having their study here. I think they stock up high tuitions just so they can complain."
"I don't mind," Manette said. "Take their money. Keep my tuition low."
I jumped as a tray clattered down onto the other side of the table.
"I assume you're talking about me."
The owner of the tray was blue-eyed and handsome, with a carefully trimmed beard and high Modegan cheekbones. He was dressed in rich, muted colors. On his hip was a knife with a worked wire hilt, the first weapon I'd seen anyone wearing at the university.
"Savoy?"
Simon looked stunned. "What are you doing here?"
"I ask myself the same thing."
Savoy looked down at the bench.
"Are there no proper chairs in this place?"
He took his seat, moving with an odd combination of graceful courtliness and stiff, affronted dignity.
"Excellent. Next I'll be eating with a trencher and throwing bones to the dogs over my shoulder."
"Etiquette dictates it to be the left shoulder, Your Highness,"
Manette said around a mouthful of bread, grinning. Savoy's eyes flashed angry, but before he could say anything, Simmons spoke up. "What happened?"
My tuition was 68 strelum, he said indignantly.
Simon looked nonplussed. Is that a lot?
It is a lot,
Savoy said sarcastically.
And for no good reason.
I answered their questions. This is a grudge, plain and simple. Mandrag does not like me. Neither does him. Besides, everyone knows they squeeze a nobility twice as hard as you lot, bleeding us dry as stones.
Simmons' nobility? Manette pointed a spoon. He seems to do fine for himself.
Savoy exhaled sharply through his nose.
Simmons' father is a paper duke bowing to a tin king in Etour. My father's stables have longer bloodlines than half you Etourian nobles.
Simmons stiffened slightly in his seat, though he didn't look up from his meal. Willem turned to face Savoy, his dark eyes going hard, but before he could say anything, Savoy slumped, rubbing his face in one hand.
I'm sorry, Sim. My house and name to you. It's just things were going to be better this term, but now they're worse instead. My allowance wouldn't even cover my tuition, and no one will extend me more credit. Do you know how humiliating that is? I've had to give up my rooms at the Golden Pony. I'm on the third floor of Muse. I almost had to share a room! What would my father say if he knew?
Simon, his mouth full, shrugged and made a gesture with his spoon that seemed to indicate that there was no offense taken.
Maybe things would go better for you if you didn't go in there looking like a peacock, Manette said. Leave off the silk when you go through admissions.
Is that how it is?
Savoy said, his temper flaring again.
Should I abase myself? Rub ashes in my hair? Tear my clothes?
As he grew angrier, his lilting accent became more pronounced.
No! They are none of them better men than me! I need not bow to them!
There was a moment of uncomfortable silence at the table. I noticed more than a few of the surrounding students were watching the show from the nearby tables.
Heitletium! Savoy continued. There is nothing in this place I do not hate. Your weather is wild and uncivilized, your religion barbaric and prudish, your horrors are intolerably ignorant and unmannerly. Your language barely has the subtlety to express how wretched this place is.
Savoy's voice grew softer the longer he spoke, until he almost seemed to be speaking to himself.
My blood goes back 50 generations, older than tree or stone, and I am come to this.
He put his head against the palms of his hands and looked down at his tin tray.
Barley bread! Gods all around us, a man is meant to eat wheat!
I watched him while chewing a mouthful of the fresh, brown bread. It tasted wonderful.
I don't know what I was thinking,
Savoy said suddenly, getting to his feet.
I can't deal with this!
He stormed off, leaving his tray on the table.
That's Savoy, Manette said to me in an offhand manner. Not a bad sort, though he's usually not nearly as drunk as that.
He's Modagan? Simon laughed. You don't get more Modagan than Savoy.
You should not prod at him, Willem said to Manette.
His rough accent made it hard for me to tell if he was rebuking the older student, but his dark, sealedish face showed definite reproach. As a foreigner, I guessed he sympathized with Savoy's difficulty adjusting to the language and culture of the Commonwealth.
He is having a rough time of it, Simon admitted.
Remember when he had to let his manservant go? Mouth full, Manette made a gesture with both hands as if playing an imaginary violin. He rolled his eyes, his expression vastly unsympathetic. He had to sell his rings this time around, I added. Willem, Simon and Manette turned to look at me curiously. There were pale lines on his fingers, I explained, holding up my hand to demonstrate. Manette gave me a close looking over.
Well, now, our new student seems to be all manner of clever.
He turned to Willem and Simon.
Lads, I'm in a betting mood. I'll wager 2 juts that our young Quoth here makes it to the Arcanum before the end of his 3rd term.
3 terms? I said, surprised. They told me all I had to do was prove I mastered the basic principles of sympathy.
Manette gave me a gentle smile. They tell everyone that. Principles of sympathy is one of the classes you'll have to slog through before they elevate you to Elir.
He turned back to Will and Sim expectantly.
How about it? 2 jots?
I'll bet.
Willem gave me a small, apologetic shrug.
No offense. I play the odds.
What'll you be studying, then?
Manette asked as they shook on it. The question caught me off guard.
Everything, I guess.
You sound like me 30 years ago, Manette chuckled. Where are you going to start?
The Chandrian, I said. I'd like to know as much about them as possible. Manette frowned, then burst out laughing.
Well, that's fine and good, I suppose. Sim here studies fairies and pixies. Will there believes in all manner of silly damned sealedish sky spirits and such.
He puffed himself up absurdly.
I'm big on imps and shamblemen myself.
I felt my face get hot with embarrassment. God's body, Manette! Sim cut him off. What's gotten into you?
I just bet 2 jots on a boy who wants to study bedtime stories,
Manette groused, gesturing to me with his fork.
He meant folklore, that sort of thing.
Willem turned to look at me.
You looking to work in the archives?
Folklore's a piece of it, I hedged quickly, eager to save face. I want to see if different cultures' folktales conform to Tekum's theory of narrative septigy. Sim turned back to Manette.
See? Why are you so twitchy today? When's the last time you slept? Don't take that tone with me, Manette grumbled. I caught a few hours last night.
And which night was that? Sim pressed. Manette paused, looking down at his tray.
Failing night?
Willem shook his head, muttering something in Siaru. Simon looked horrified.
Manette! Yesterday was kindling. Has it been 2 days since you've slept?
Probably not, Manette said uncertainly. I always lose track of things during admissions. There aren't any classes. It throws off my schedule. Besides, I've been caught up in a project in the fishery.
He trailed off, scrubbing at his face with his hands, then looked up at me.
They're right. I'm a little off my head right now. Tekum Septigy folklore and all that. It's a bit bookish for me, but a fine thing to study. I didn't mean any offense.
None taken, I said easily and nodded at Sovoy's tray. Slide that over here, would you? If our young noble's not coming back, I'll have his bread. After Simon took me to sign up for classes, I made my way to the archives, eager to have a look around after all these years of dreaming. This time, when I entered the archives, there was a young gentleman sitting behind the desk, tapping a pen on a piece of paper that bore the marks of much rewriting and crossing out. As I approached, he scowled and scratched out another line. His face was built to scowl. His hands were soft and pale. His blinding white linen shirt and richly dyed blue vest reeked of money. The part of me that was not long removed from Tarbian wanted to pick his pocket. He tapped his pen for another few moments before laying it down with a vastly irritated sigh.
Name, he said without looking up.
Quoth. He flipped through the ledger, found a particular page, and frowned.
You're not in the book.
He glanced up briefly and scowled again before turning back to whatever verse he was laboring over. When I made no signs of leaving, he flicked his fingers as if shooing away a bug.
Feel free to piss off.
I've just... Ambrose put down his pen again.
Listen, he said slowly, as if explaining to a simpleton. You're not in the book.
He made an exaggerated gesture toward the ledger with both hands.
You don't get inside.
He made another gesture to the inner doors.
The end.
I've just gone through admissions.
He tossed up his hands, exasperated. "Then of course you're not in the book!" I dug into my pocket for my admission slip. "Master Lauren gave me this himself." "I don't care if he carried you here piggyback," Ambrose said, pointedly redipping his pen. "Now quit wasting my time. I have things to do." "Wasting your time?" I demanded, my temper finally wearing thin. "Do you have any idea what I've gone through to get here?" Ambrose looked up at me, his expression growing suddenly amused. "Wait, let me guess," he said, laying his hands flat on the table and pushing himself to his feet. "You were always smarter than the other children back in Clodhump or whatever little one-whore town you're from. Your ability to read and count left the local villagers awestruck." I heard the outer door open and shut behind me, but Ambrose didn't pay it any attention as he walked around to lean against the front of the desk. "Your parents knew you were special, so they saved up for a couple of years, bought you a pair of shoes, and sewed the pig blanket into a shirt." He reached out to rub the fabric of my new clothes between his fingers. "It took months of walking, hundreds of miles bumping along in the backs of mule carts, but in the end..." He made an expansive gesture with both hands. "Praise Talu and all his angels, here you are, all bright-eyed and full of dreams." I heard laughter and turned to see that two men and a young woman had come in during his tirade.
"God's body, Ambrose, what's got you started?"
"Goddamn first-termers," Ambrose groused as he headed back around to sit behind the desk. "Come in here dressed like ragpiles and act like they own the place." The three newcomers walked toward the doors marked stacks. I fought down a hot flush of embarrassment as they looked me up and down.
"Are we still heading to the Aeolian tonight?"
Ambrose nodded.
"Of course. Sixth bell."
"Aren't you going to check to see if they're in the book?" I asked as the door closed behind them. Ambrose turned back to me, his smile bright, brittle, and by no means friendly.
"Listen, I'm going to give you a little advice for free. Back home, you were something special. Here, you're just another kid with a big mouth. So address me as Relar. Go back to your bunk and thank whatever pagan god you pray to that we're not in Vintus. My father and I would chain you to a post like a rabid dog."
He shrugged.
"Or don't. Stay here. Make a scene. Start to cry. Better yet, take a swing at me."
He smiled. "I'll give you a thrashing and get you thrown out on your ear." He picked up his pen and turned back to whatever he was writing. I left. You might think that this encounter left me disheartened. You might think I felt betrayed, my childhood dreams of the university cruelly shattered. Quite the contrary. It reassured me. I had been feeling rather out of my element until Ambrose let me know, in his own special way, that there wasn't much difference between the university and the streets of Tarbian. No matter where you are, people are basically the same. Besides, anger can keep you warm at night, and wounded pride can spur a man to wondrous things. Chapter 38. Sympathy in the Mains. Mains was the oldest building at the university. Over the centuries, it had grown slowly in all directions, engulfing smaller buildings and courtyards as it spread. And it had the look of an ambitious architectural breed of lichen that was trying to cover as many acres as it could. It was a hard place to find your way around. Hallways took odd turns, dead-ended unexpectedly, or took long, rambling, roundabout paths. It could easily take 20 minutes to walk from one room to another, despite the fact that they were only 50 feet apart. More experienced students knew shortcuts, of course, which workrooms and lecture halls to cut through to reach your destination. At least one of the courtyards had been completely isolated and could only be accessed by climbing through a window. Rumor had it, there were some rooms bricked off entirely, some with students still inside. Their ghosts were rumored to walk the halls at night, bewailing their fate and complaining about the food in the mess. My first class was held in Mainz. Luckily, I had been warned by my bunkmates that Mainz was difficult to navigate, so despite getting lost, I still arrived with time to spare. When I finally found the room for my first class, I was surprised to find it resembled a small theater. Seats rose in tiered semicircles around a small, raised stage. In larger cities, my troupe had performed in places not unlike this one. The thought relaxed me as I found a seat in the back. I was a jangling mass of excitement as I watched other students slowly trickle into the room. Everyone was older than me by at least a few years. I reviewed the first 30 sympathetic bindings in my head as the theater filled with anxious students. There were perhaps 50 of us in all, making the room about 3/4 full. Some had pen and paper with hardbacks to write on. Some had wax tablets. I hadn't brought anything, but that didn't worry me over much. I've always had an excellent memory. Master Hem entered the room and made his way onto the stage to stand behind a large stone work table. He looked impressive in his dark master's robes, and it was bare seconds before the whispering, shuffling theater of students hushed to silence.
"So, you want to be arcanists?" he said. "You want magic like you've heard about in bedtime stories. You've listened to songs about Tamerlan the Great, roaring sheets of fire, magic rings, invisible cloaks, swords that never go dull, potions to make you fly."
He shook his head disgusted.
"Well, if that's what you're looking for, you can leave now, because you won't find it here. It doesn't exist."
At this point, a student came in, realized he was late, and moved quickly into a vacant seat. Hem spotted him, though.
"Hello! Glad you chose to attend. What's your name?"
"Gil," the boy said nervously. "I'm sorry, I had a bit of a hard time—"
"Gil," Hem interrupted. "Why are you here?"
Gel gaped for a moment before managing to say,
"For principles of sympathy?"
"I do not appreciate tardiness in my class. For tomorrow you may prepare a report on the development of the sympathy clock, its differences from the previous, more arbitrary clocks that used harmonic motion, and its effect on the accurate treatment of time."
The boy twisted in his seat.
"Yes, sir."
Hem seemed satisfied with the reaction.
"Very well. What is sympathy, then?"
Another boy hurried in, clutching a hardback. He was young, by which I mean he looked to be no more than 2 years older than me. Hem stopped him before he could make it into a seat.
"Hello there," he said in an over-courteous tone. "And you are?"
"Basil, sir."
The boy stood awkwardly in the aisle. I recognized him. I had spied on his admissions interview.
"Basil, you wouldn't happen to be from Ill, would you?"
Hem asked, smiling sharply.
"No, sir."
"Ah," Hem said, feigning disappointment. "I had heard that Yilish tribes use the sun to tell time, and as such have no true concept of punctuality. However, as you are not Yilish, I can see no excuse for being late. Can you?"
Basil's mouth worked silently for a moment, as if to make some excuse, then apparently decided better of it.
"No, sir."
"Good. For tomorrow you can prepare a report on Yil's lunar calendar compared to the more accurate, civilized Aturan calendar that you should be familiar with by now. Be seated."
Basil slunk wordlessly into a nearby seat like a whipped dog. Hem gave up all pretext of lecture and lay in wait for the next tardy student. Thus it was that the hall was tensely silent when she stepped hesitantly into the room. It was a young woman of about 18, a rarity of sorts. The ratio of men to women in the university is about 10-1. Hem's manner softened when she entered the room. He moved quickly up the steps to greet her.
"Ah, my dear, I'm suddenly pleased that we have not yet begun today's discussion."
He took her by the elbow and led her down a few of the steps to the first available seat. She was obviously embarrassed by the attention.
I'm sorry, Master Hem. Mains is bigger than I guessed.
No worry, Hem said in a kindly fashion. You're here, and that's what matters. He solicitously helped her arrange her paper and ink before returning to the stage. Once there, it seemed as if he might actually lecture. But before he began, he looked back to the girl.
I'm sorry, miss. She was the only woman in the room. Poor manners on my part. What is your name?
Rhea.
Rhea? Is that short for Rian?
Yes, it is.
She smiled.
Rian, would you please cross your legs?
The request was made with such an earnest tone that not even a titter escaped the class. Looking around, Rian crossed her legs.
Now that the gates of hell are closed, Hem said in his normal, rougher tones, we can begin.
And so he did, ignoring her for the rest of the lecture, which, as I see it, was an inadvertent kindness. It was a long 2.5 hours. I listened attentively, always hoping that he would come to something I hadn't learned from Abinthy. But there was nothing. I quickly realized that while Hem was discussing the principles of sympathy, he was doing it at a very, very basic level. This class was a colossal waste of my time. After Hem dismissed the class, I ran down the stairs and caught him just as he was leaving through a lower door.
Master Hem!
He turned to face me.
Oh, yes. Our boy prodigy. I wasn't aware you were in my class. I didn't go too fast for you, did I?
I knew better than to answer that honestly.
You covered the basics very clearly, sir. The principles you mentioned today will lay a good foundation for the other students in the class.
Diplomacy is a large part of being a trooper. He puffed up a bit at my perceived compliment, then looked more closely at me.
Other students?
He asked. I'm afraid I'm already familiar with the basics, sir. I know the 3 laws and the 14 corollaries, as well as the first 90...
Yes, I see. He cut me off. I'm rather busy at the moment. We can speak of this tomorrow before class.
He turned and walked briskly away. Half a loaf being better than none, I shrugged and headed for the archives. If I wasn't going to learn anything from Hem's lectures, I might as well start educating myself. This time when I entered the archives, there was a young woman sitting behind the desk. She was strikingly beautiful, with long, dark hair and clear, bright eyes. A notable improvement over Ambrose, to be sure. She smiled as I approached the desk.
What's your name?
Quoth, I said, son of Arladin. She nodded and began to page through the ledger. What's yours? I asked to fill the silence.
Fella,
she said without looking up, then nodded to herself and tapped the ledger.
There you are. Go on in.
There were 2 sets of double doors leading out of the antechamber. One marked Stacks, and the other Tomes. Not knowing the difference between the two, I headed to the ones labeled Stacks. That was what I wanted. Stacks of books. Great heaps of books. Shelf after endless shelf of books. I had my hands on the handles of the doors before Fella's voice stopped me.
I'm sorry. It's your first time in here, isn't it?
I nodded, not letting go of the door's handles. I was so close. What was going to happen now?
The Stacks are arcanum only,
she said apologetically. She stood up and walked around the desk to the other set of doors.
Here, let me show you.
I reluctantly let go of the door's handles and followed her. Using both hands, she tugged one of the heavy wooden doors open, revealing a large, high-ceilinged room filled with long tables. 12 students were scattered throughout the room, reading. The room was well lit with the unwavering light of dozens of sympathy lamps. Fella leaned close to me and spoke in a soft voice.
This is the main reading area. You'll find all the necessary tomes used for most of the basic classes.
She blocked the door open with her foot and pointed along one wall to a long section of shelving with 300 or 400 books. More books than I had ever seen in one place before. Fella continued to speak softly.
It's a quiet place. No talking above a whisper. I noticed that the room was almost unnaturally quiet. If you want a book that isn't there, you can submit a request at the desk, she pointed. They'll find the book and bring it out to you. I turned to ask her a question, and only then realized how close she was standing. It says a great deal about how enamored I was with the archives that I failed to notice one of the most attractive women in the university standing less than 6 inches away.
How long does it usually take them to find a book?
I asked quietly, trying not to stare at her. It varies. She brushed her long black hair over her shoulder. Sometimes we're busier than others. Some people are better at finding the appropriate books.
She shrugged and some of her hair swung back down to brush against my arm.
Usually no more than an hour.
I nodded, disappointed by not being able to browse the whole of the archives, but still excited to be inside. Once again, half a loaf was better than none.
Thanks, fella.
I went inside, and she let the door swing shut behind me. But she came after me just a moment later.
One last thing, she said quietly. I mean, it goes without saying, but this is your first time here.
Her expression was serious.
The books don't leave this room. Nothing leaves the archives.
Of course, I said. Naturally. I hadn't known. Fella smiled and nodded.
I just wanted to make sure. A couple of years ago, we had a young gent who was used to carrying off books from his father's library. I'd never even seen Lauren frown before that, or talk much above a whisper. But when he caught that boy in the street with one of his books...
She shook her head as if she couldn't hope to explain what she had seen. I tried to picture the tall, somber master angry and failed.
Thanks for the warning. Don't mention it.
Fella headed back out into the entrance hall. I approached the desk she had pointed out to me.
How do I request a book?
I asked the scrib quietly. He showed me a large log book half filled with students' names and their requests. Some were requests for books with specific titles or authors, but others were more general requests for information. One of the entries caught my eye. Basil, Yilish Lunar Calendar, History of a Turin Calendar. I looked around the room and saw the boy from Hem's class hunched over a book, taking notes. I wrote, quote, The History of the Chandrian, Reports of the Chandrian and Their Signs, Black Eyes, Blue Flame, etc. I went to the shelves next and started looking over books. I recognized one or two from my studies with Ben. The only sound in the room was the occasional scratch of a pen on paper, or the faint bird-wing sound of a page turning. Rather than being unsettling, I found the quiet strangely comforting. Later, I was to find out that the place was nicknamed Tombs because of its crypt-like quiet. Eventually, a book called The Mating Habits of the Common Dracus caught my eye, and I took it over to one of the reading tables. I picked it because it had a rather stylish embossed dragon on the cover, but when I started reading, I discovered it was an educated investigation into several common myths. I was halfway through the title piece, explaining how the myth of the dragon, in all likelihood, evolved from the much older mundane Dracus, when a scriv appeared at my elbow.
Quoth?
I nodded, and he handed me a small book with a blue cloth cover. Opening it, I was instantly disappointed. It was a collection of fairy stories. I flipped through it, hoping to find something useful, but it was filled with sticky sweet adventure stories meant to amuse children. You know the sort. Brave orphans trick the Chandrian, win riches, marry princesses, and live happily ever after. I sighed and closed the book. I had half expected this. Until the Chandrian killed my family, I thought there were nothing more than children's stories, too. This sort of search wasn't going to get me anywhere. After walking to the desk, I thought for a long moment before writing a new line in the request ledger. Quoth, The History of the Order Aemir, The Origins of the Aemir, The Practices of the Aemir. I reached the end of the line, and rather than start another one,
I stopped and looked up at the scriv behind the desk. I'll take anything on the Amir, really, I said.
We're a little busy right now, he said, gesturing to the room.
Another dozen or so students had filtered in since I had arrived. But we'll bring something out as soon as we can. I returned to the table and flipped through the children's book again before abandoning it for the bestiary. The wait was much longer this time, and I was learning about the strange summer hibernation of Sasquinian when I felt a light touch on my shoulder. I turned, expecting to see a scriv with an armload of books, or maybe Basil come to say hello. I was startled by the sight of Master Lauren looming over me in his dark master's robes.
Come, he said softly, and gestured for me to follow.
Not knowing what might be the matter, I followed him out of the reading room. We walked behind the scriv's desk and down a flight of stairs to a small, featureless room with a table and two chairs. The archives was filled with little rooms like this, reading holes designed to give members of the Arcanum a place to sit privately and study. Lauren laid the request ledger from Tomes on the table.
I noticed your request while assisting one of the newer scrivs in his duties, he said. You have an interest in the Chandrian and the Emir?
He asked.
I nodded. Is this in regard to an assignment from one of your instructors?
For a moment, I thought about telling him the truth, about what had happened to my parents, about the story I had heard in Tarbian. But Manette's reaction to my mention of the Chandrian had shown me how foolish that would be. Until I'd seen the Chandrian myself, I didn't believe in them. If anyone would have claimed to have seen them, I would have thought they were crazy. At best, Lauren would think I was delusional. At worst, a foolish child. I was suddenly pointedly aware of the fact that I was standing in one of the cornerstones of civilization, talking to the master archivist of the university. It put things in a new perspective for me. The stories of an old man in some dockside tavern suddenly seemed very far away and insignificant. I shook my head. No, sir. It's merely to satisfy my curiosity.
I have a great respect for curiosity, Lauren said with no particular inflection. Perhaps I can satisfy yours a bit. The Emir were part of the church back when the Aeturan Empire was still strong. Their credo was Ivare Enim Yuge, which roughly translates as for the greater good. They were equal part knight-errant and vigilante. They had judiciary powers and could act as judges in both the religious and secular courts. All of them, to varying degrees, were exempt from the law.
I knew most of this already. But where did they come from? I asked. It was as close as I dared come to mentioning Scarpy's story.
They evolved from traveling judges, Lauren said, men who went from town to town, bringing the rule of law to small Aeturan towns.
They originated in Aetur, then? He looked at me.
Where else would they have originated?
I couldn't bring myself to tell him the truth, that because of an old man's story, I suspected the Emir might have roots much older than the Aeturan Empire, that I hoped they might still exist somewhere in the world today. Lauren took my silence as a response.
A piece of advice, he said gently. The Emir are dramatic figures. When we are young, we all pretend to be Emir and fight battles with willow-switch swords. It is natural for boys to be attracted to those stories. He met my eyes. However, a man, an arcanist, must focus himself on the present day. He must attend to practical things.
He held my eyes as he continued to speak.
You are young. Many will judge you by that fact alone.
I drew a breath, but he held up a hand.
I am not accusing you of engaging in boyish fancy. I am advising you to avoid the appearance of boyish fancy.
He gave me a level look, his face as calm as always. I thought of the way Ambrose had treated me and nodded, feeling color rise to my cheeks.
Lauren brought out a pen and drew a series of hashes through my single line of writing in the ledger book. "I have a great respect for curiosity," he said, "but others do not think as I do. I would not see your first term unnecessarily complicated by such things. I expect things will be difficult enough for you without that additional worry." I bowed my head, feeling as if I'd somehow disappointed him. "I understand. Thank you, sir."
Chapter 39. Enough Rope.
The next day, I was 10 minutes early to Hem's class, sitting in the front row. I hoped to catch Hem before the class started, thereby saving myself from having to sit through another one of his lectures. Unfortunately, he did not appear early. The lecture hall was full when he entered by the hall's lower door and climbed the 3 steps onto the raised wooden stage. He looked around the hall, eyes searching me out.
"Ah, yes, our young prodigy. Stand up, would you?"
Uncertain as to what was going on, I stood.
"I have pleasant news for everyone," he said. "Mr. Quoth here has assured me as to his complete grasp of the principles of sympathy. In doing so, he has offered to give today's lecture."
He made an expansive gesture for me to join him on the stage. He smiled at me with hard eyes.
"Mr. Quoth?"
He was mocking me, of course, expecting me to slink down into my seat, cowed and ashamed. But I had had enough of bullies in my life. So I climbed onto the stage and shook his hand. Using a good stage voice, I spoke to the students.
"I thank Master Hem for this opportunity. I only hope that I can help him shed some light on this most important subject."
Having started this little game, Hem was unable to stop it without looking foolish. As he shook my hand, he gave me the look a wolf gives a treed cat. Smiling to himself, he left the stage to assume my recently vacated seat in the front row. Confident of my ignorance, he was willing to let the charade continue. I would never have gotten away with it if not for 2 of Hem's numerous flaws. First, his general stupidity in not believing what I had told him the day before. Second, his desire to see me embarrassed as thoroughly as possible. Plainly said, he was giving me enough rope to hang myself with. Apparently, he didn't realize that once a noose is tied, it will fit one neck as easily as another. I faced the class. "Today I will be presenting an example of the laws of sympathy. However, as time is limited, I will need help with the preparations." I pointed to a student at random. "Would you be so good as to bring me one of Master Hem's hairs, please?" Hem offered one up with an exaggerated graciousness. As the student brought it up to me, Hem smiled in genuine amusement, certain that the more grandiose my preparations were, the greater my embarrassment would be in the end. I took advantage of this slight delay to look over what equipment I had to work with. A brazier set off to one side of the stage, and a quick rifling of the drawers in the work table revealed chalk, a prism, sulfur matches, an enlarging glass, some candles, and a few oddly shaped blocks of metal. I took 3 of the candles and left the rest. I took Master Hem's hair from the student and recognized him as Basil, the boy Hem had browbeat yesterday. "Thank you, Basil. Would you bring that brazier over here and get it burning as quickly as you can?" As he brought it closer, I was delighted to see that it was equipped with a small bellows. While he poured alcohol onto the coal and struck a spark to it, I addressed the class. "The concepts of sympathy are not entirely easy to grasp, but underneath everything there remain 3 simple laws. First is the doctrine of correspondence, which says similarity enhances sympathy. Second is the principle of consanguinity, which says a piece of a thing can represent the whole of a thing. Third is the law of conservation, which says energy cannot be destroyed nor created. Correspondence, consanguinity, and conservation, the 3 C's.
I paused and listened to the sound of a half-hundred pens scratching down my words. Beside me, Basil pumped industriously at the bellows. I realized I could grow to enjoy this. "Don't worry if it doesn't make sense yet. The demonstration should make everything abundantly clear." Looking down, I saw the brazier was warming nicely. I thanked Basil and hung a shallow metal pan above the coals and dropped two of the candles in to melt. I set a third candle in a holder on the table and used one of the sulfur matches in the drawer to set it alight. Next, I moved the pan off the heat and poured its now melted contents carefully onto the table, forming a fist-sized blob of soft wax. I looked back up at the students. "In sympathy, most of what you are doing is redirecting energy. Sympathetic links are how the energy travels." I pulled out the wicking and began kneading the wax into a roughly human-shaped doll. "The first law I mentioned, similarity enhances sympathy, simply means that the more things resemble each other, the stronger the sympathetic link between them will be." I held the crude doll up for the class to inspect. "This," I said, "is Master Hem." Laughter muttered back and forth across the hall. "Actually, this is my sympathetic representation of Master Hem. Would anyone like to take a guess as to why it is not a very good one?" There was a moment of silence. I let it stretch out for a while. A cold audience. Hem had traumatized them yesterday, and they were slow in responding. Finally, from the back of the room, a student said, "It's the wrong size." I nodded and continued to look around the room.
"He isn't made of wax, either."
I nodded. "It does bear some small resemblance to him, in general shape and proportion. Nevertheless, it is a very poor sympathetic representation. Because of that, any sympathetic link based off it would be rather weak. Perhaps 2% efficiency. How could we improve it?" There was another silence, shorter than the first.
"You could make it bigger," someone suggested.
I nodded and waited. Other voices called out,
"You could carve Master Hem's face on it. Paint it.
Give it a little robe."
Everyone laughed. I held up my hand for quiet and was surprised by how quickly it fell. Practicality aside, assume you did all these things. A 6-foot, fully clothed, masterfully carved Master Hem stands beside me, I gestured. Even with all that effort, the best you might hope for is 10 or 15% sympathetic link. Not very good. Not very good at all. This brings me to the second law, consanguinity. An easy way to think of it is, once together, always together. Due to Master Hem's generosity, I have one of his hairs. I held it up and ceremoniously stuck it on the head of the doll. And as easy as this, we have a sympathetic link that will work at 30 to 35%. I had been watching Hem. While at first he seemed a little wary, he had lapsed back into a self-satisfied smirk. He knew that without the appropriate binding and properly focused ailer, all the wax and hair in the world wouldn't do one whit of good. Sure that he had taken me for a fool, I gestured to the candle and asked him, "With your permission, Master?" He made a magnanimous wave of compliance and settled back into his chair, folding his arms in front of him, confident in his safety. Of course, I did know the binding. I told him so, and Ben had taught me about the ailer, the riding crop belief, back when I was 12. But I didn't bother with either. I put the doll's foot into the candle flame, which guttered and smoked. There was a tense, held-breath quiet as everyone stretched in their seats to get a look at Master Hem. Hem shrugged, feigning astonishment, but his eyes had the look of a jaw-trap about to close. A smirk tugged at one corner of his mouth, and he began to rise from his seat.
"I feel nothing, but—"
"Exactly," I said, cracking my voice like a whip, startling the students' attention back to me. "And why is that?" I looked expectantly at the lecture hall. "Because of the third law that I mentioned, conservation. Energy cannot be destroyed or created, merely lost or found.
If I were to hold a candle underneath our esteemed teacher's foot, very little would occur. And since only about 30% of the heat is getting through, we do not even get that small result. I paused to let them think for a moment. This is the prime problem in sympathy. Where do we get the energy? Here, however, the answer is simple. I blew out the candle and relit it from the brazier, muttering the few necessary words underneath my breath. By adding a second sympathetic link between the candle and a more substantial fire, I broke my mind into two pieces, one binding Hem and the doll together, the other connecting the candle and the brazier. We get the desired effect. I casually moved the foot of the wax doll into the space about an inch above the candle's wick, which is actually the hottest part of the flame. There was a startled exclamation from where Hem was sitting. Without looking in his direction, I continued speaking to the class in the driest of tones. "And it appears that this time we are successful." The class laughed. I blew out the candle. This is also a good example of the power that a clever sympathist commands. Imagine what would happen if I were to throw this doll into the fire itself. I held it over the brazier. As if on cue, Hem stormed onto the stage. It may have been my imagination, but it seemed to me that he was favoring his left leg slightly. "It appears that Master Hem wishes to resume your instruction at this point." Laughter rippled through the room, louder this time. "I thank you all, students and friends, and thus my humble lecture ends." At this point, I used one of the tricks of the stage. There is a certain inflection of voice and body language that signals a crowd to applaud. I cannot explain how exactly it is done, but it had its intended effect. I nodded my head to them and turned to face Hem amidst applause, which, though far from deafening, was probably more than any he had ever received. As he took the last few steps toward me, I almost backed away. His face was a fearsome red, and a vein pulsed at his temple as if it were about to explode. For my own part, my stage training helped me maintain my composure. I returned his gaze levelly and held out my hand for him to shake. It was with no small account of satisfaction that I watched him give a quick glance to the still applauding class, swallow, and shake my hand. His handshake was painfully tight. It might have gotten worse if I hadn't made a slight gesture over the brazier with the wax doll. His face went from its livid red to an ashen white more quickly than I would have believed possible. His grip underwent a similar transformation, and I regained my hand. With another nod toward the seated students, I left the lecture hall without a backward glance. Chapter 40. On the Horns. After Hem dismissed his class, news of what I had done spread through the university like wildfire. I guessed from the students' reactions that Master Hem was not particularly well-loved. As I sat on a stone bench outside the mews, passing students smiled in my direction. Others waved or gave laughing thumbs up. While I enjoyed the notoriety, a cold anxiety was slowly growing in my gut. I'd made an enemy of one of the 9 masters. I needed to know how much trouble I was in. Dinner in the mess was brown bread with butter, stew, and beans. Manette was there, his wild hair making him look like a great white wolf. Simon and Sauvoy groused idly about the food, making grim speculations as to what manner of meat was in the stew. To me, less than a span away from the streets of Tarbian, it was a marvelous meal indeed. Nevertheless, I was rapidly losing my appetite in the face of what I was hearing from my friends.
"Don't get me wrong," Sauvoy said. "You've got a great weighty pair on you. I'll never call that into question. But still," he gestured with his spoon, "they're going to string you up for this."
"If he's lucky," Simon said. "I mean, we are talking about malfeasance here, aren't we?" "It's not a big deal," I said with more assurance than I felt. "I gave him a little bit of a hot foot, that's all."
"Any harmful sympathy falls under malfeasance," Manette
pointed at me with his piece of bread,
his wild, grizzled eyebrows arching seriously over his nose.
"You've got to pick your battles, boy. Keep your head down around the masters. They can make your life a real hell once you get into their bad books."
"He started it," I said sullenly through a mouthful of beans. A young boy jogged up to the table, breathless.
"Your Quoth?"
he asked, looking me over. I nodded, my stomach suddenly turning over.
"They want you in the Master's Hall."
"Where is it?" I asked. "I've only been here a couple of days."
"Can one of you show him?"
the boy asked, looking around the table.
"I've got to go tell Jameson I found him."
"I'll do it," Simmons said, pushing away his bowl. "I'm not hungry anyway." Jameson's runner boy took off, and Simmons started to get to his feet.
"Hold on," I said, pointing to my tray with my spoon. "I'm not finished here."
Simmons' expression was anxious.
"I can't believe you're eating," he said. "I can't eat. How can you eat?"
"I'm hungry," I said. "I don't know what's waiting in the Master's Hall, but I'm guessing I'd rather have a full stomach for it."
"You're going on the horns," Manette said. "It's the only reason they'd call you there at this time of night."
I didn't know what he meant by that, but I didn't want to advertise my ignorance to everyone in the room. "They can wait until I'm done." I took another bite of stew. Simmons returned to his seat and poked idly at his food. Truth be told, I wasn't really hungry anymore, but it galled me to be pulled away from a meal after all the times I'd been hungry in Tarbian. When Simmons and I finally got to our feet, the normal clamor in the mess quieted as folk watched us leave. They knew where I was headed. Outside, Simmons put his hands in his pockets and headed roughly in the direction of Hollows. "All kidding aside, you're in a good bit of trouble, you know." "I was hoping Hem would be embarrassed and keep quiet about it," I admitted. "Do they expel many students?" I tried to make it sound like a joke. "There hasn't been anyone this term," Sim said with his shy, blue-eyed smile. "But it's only the second day of classes. You might set some sort of record." "This isn't funny," I said, but found myself wearing a grin regardless. Simon could always make me smile, no matter what was going on. Sim led the way, and we reached Hollows far too soon for my liking. Simon raised a hand in a hesitant farewell as I opened the door and made my way inside. I was met by Jameson. He oversaw everything that wasn't under direct control of the masters. The kitchen, the laundry, the stables, the stock rooms. He was nervous and bird-like. A man with the body of a sparrow and the eyes of a hawk. Jameson escorted me into a large windowless room with a familiar crescent-shaped table. The Chancellor sat at the center, as he had during admissions. The only real difference was that this table was not elevated, and the seated masters were close to eye level with me. The eyes I met were not friendly. Jameson escorted me to the front of the crescent table. Seeing it from this angle made me understand the references to being on the horns. Jameson retreated to a smaller table of his own, dipping a pen. The Chancellor steepled his fingers and spoke without preamble.
"On the 4th of Catellan, Hem called the masters together."
Jameson's pen scratched across a piece of paper, occasionally dipping back into the inkwell at the top of the desk. The Chancellor continued formally.
"Are all the masters present?"
"Master Physicker," said Arwell.
"Master Archivist," said Lauren, his face impassive as ever.
"Master Arithmetician,"
Brandur said, cracking his knuckles absently.
"Master Artificer,"
grumbled Kilvin without looking up from the tabletop.
"Master Alchemist," said Mandrag.
"Master Rhetorician."
Hem's face was fierce and red.
"Master Sympathist,"
said Alxadal.
"Master Namer."
Elodin actually smiled at me. Not just a perfunctory curling of the lips, but a warm, toothy grin. I drew a bit of a shaky breath,
relieved that at least one person present didn't seem eager to hang me up by my thumbs.
"And Master Linguist," said the Chancellor. "All eight," he frowned. "Sorry, strike that. All nine masters are present. Present your grievance, Master Hem."
Hem did not hesitate.
"Today, first-term student Kvothe, not of the Arcanum, did perform sympathetic bindings on me with malicious intent."
"Two grievances are recorded against Kvothe by Master Hem," the Chancellor said sternly, not taking his eyes away from me. "First grievance, unauthorized use of sympathy. What is the proper discipline for this, Master Archivist?"
"For unauthorized use of sympathy leading to injury, the offending student will be bound and whipped a number of times, not less than 2, nor more than 10, singly across the back."
Lauren said it as if reading off directions for a recipe.
"Number of lashes sought?"
The Chancellor looked at Hem. Hem paused to consider.
5.
I felt the blood drain from my face, and I forced myself to take a slow, deep breath through my nose to calm myself.
"Does any master object to this?"
The Chancellor looked around the table, but all mouths were silent. All eyes were stern.
"The second grievance, malfeasance. Master Archivist?"
4 to 15 single lashes and expulsion from the university,"
Lauren said in a level voice.
"Lashes sought?"
Hem stared directly at me.
8.
13 lashes and expulsion. A cold sweat swept over me, and I felt nausea in the pit of my stomach. I had known fear before. In Tarbian, it was never far away. Fear kept you alive. But I had never before felt such a desperate helplessness. A fear not just for my body being hurt, but for my entire life being ruined. I began to get lightheaded.
"Do you understand these grievances set against you?" the Chancellor asked sternly.
I took a deep breath.
"Not exactly, sir."
I hated the way my voice sounded, tremulous and weak. The Chancellor held up a hand, and Jameson lifted his pen from the paper.
"It is against the laws of the university for a student who is not a member of the Arcanum to use sympathy without permission from a master."
His expression darkened.
"And it is always, always expressly forbidden to cause harm with sympathy, especially to a master. A few hundred years ago, Arcanists were hunted down and burned for things of that sort. We do not tolerate that sort of behavior here."
I heard a hard edge creep into the Chancellor's voice. Only then did I sense how truly angry he was. He took a deep breath.
"Now do you understand?"
I nodded shakily. He made another motion to Jameson, who set his pen back to the paper.
"Do you, Kvothe, understand these grievances set against you?"
"Yes, sir,"
I said as steadily as I could. Everything seemed too bright, and my legs were trembling slightly. I tried to force them to be still, but it only seemed to make them shake all the more.
"Do you have anything to say in your defense?"
the Chancellor asked curtly. I just wanted to leave. I felt the stares of the masters bearing down on me. My hands were wet and cold. I probably would have shaken my head and slunk from the room had the Chancellor not spoken again.
"Well?"
the Chancellor repeated testily.
"No defense?"
The words struck a chord in me. They were the same words that Ben had used 100 times as he drilled me endlessly in argument. His words came back, admonishing me.
"What? No defense? Any student of mine must be able to defend his ideas against an attack. No matter how you spend your life, your wit will defend you more often than a sword. Keep it sharp."
I took another deep breath, closed my eyes, and concentrated. After a long moment, I felt the cool impassivity of the heart of stone surround me. My trembling stopped. I opened my eyes and heard my own voice say, I had permission for my use of sympathy, sir. The Chancellor gave me a long, hard look before saying,
What?
I held the Heart of Stone around me like a calming mantle. I had permission from Master Hem, both express and implied. The Masters stirred in their seats, puzzled. The Chancellor looked far from pleased.
Explain yourself.
I approached Master Hem after his first lecture and told him I was already familiar with the concepts he had discussed. He told me we would discuss it the next day. When he arrived for class the next day, he announced that I would be giving the lecture in order to demonstrate the principles of sympathy. After observing what materials were available, I gave the class the first demonstration my master gave me. Not true, of course. As I've already mentioned, my first lesson involved a handful of iron drabs. It was a lie, but a plausible lie. Judging by the master's expressions, this was news to them. Somewhere deep in the Heart of Stone, I relaxed, glad that the master's irritation was based on Hem's angrily abridged version of the truth.
You gave a demonstration before the class? The Chancellor asked before I could continue.
He glanced at Hem, then back at me.
I played innocent.
Just a simple one. Is that unusual?
It is a little odd, he said, looking at Hem. I could sense his anger again, but this time it didn't seem to be directed at me.
I thought it might be the way you proved your knowledge of material and moved to a more advanced class. I said innocently. Another lie, but again plausible.
Elxadal spoke up.
What did the demonstration involve?
A wax doll, a hair from Hem's head, and a candle. I would have picked a different example, but my materials were limited. I thought that might be another part of the test, making do with what you were given. I shrugged again. I couldn't think of any other way to demonstrate all three laws with the materials on hand.
The Chancellor looked at Hem. Is what the boy says true?
Hem opened his mouth as if he would deny it, then apparently remembered that an entire classroom full of students had witnessed the exchange. He said nothing.
Damn it, Hem! Elxadal burst out. You let the boy make a simulacra of you, then bring him here on malfeasance? He sputtered. You deserve worse than you got!
Elir Kvoth could not have hurt him with just a candle,
Kilvin muttered. He gave his fingers a puzzled look, as if he were working something out in his head.
Not with hair and wax. Maybe blood and clay. Order!
The Chancellor's voice was too quiet to be called a shout, but it carried the same authority. He shot looks at Elxadal and Kilvin.
Quoth, answer Master Kilvin's question.
I made a second binding between the candle and the brazier to illustrate the law of conservation. Kilvin did not look up from his hands.
Wax and hair?
He grumbled, as if not entirely satisfied with my explanation. I gave a half-puzzled, half-embarrassed look and said, I don't understand it myself, sir. I should have gotten 10% transference at best. It shouldn't have been enough to blister Master Hem, let alone burn him. I turned to Hem. I really didn't mean any harm, sir, I said in my best distraught voice. It was just supposed to be a bit of a hot foot to make you jump. The fire hadn't been going more than 5 minutes, and I didn't imagine that a fresh fire at 10% could hurt you. I even wrung my hands a little, every bit the distraught student. It was a good performance. My father would have been proud.
Well, it did, Hem said bitterly. And where is the damn Mommet, anyway? I demand you return it at once.
I'm afraid I can't, sir. I destroyed it. It was too dangerous to leave laying around.
Hem gave me a shrewd look. It's of no real concern, he muttered.
The Chancellor took up the reins again.
This changes things considerably. Hem, do you still set grievance against Kvoth?
Hem glared and said nothing.
I move to strike both grievances, Arwill said,
the Physicker's old voice coming as a bit of a surprise. If Hem set him in front of the class, he gave permission. And it isn't malfeasance if you give him your hair and watch him stick it on the mommet's head.
I expected him to have more control over what he was doing, Hem said, shooting a venomous look at me.
It's not malfeasance, Arwill said doggedly, glaring at Hem from behind his spectacles, the grandfatherly lines on his face forming a fierce scowl.
It would fall under reckless use of sympathy, Lauren interjected coolly.
Is that a motion to strike the previous two grievances and replace them with reckless use of sympathy?
Asked the Chancellor, trying to regain a semblance of formality.
Aye, said Arwill, still glaring fearsomely at Hem through his spectacles. All for the motion? The Chancellor said.
There was a chorus of ayes from everyone but Hem.
Against?
Hem remained silent.
Master Archivist, what is the discipline for reckless use of sympathy?
If one is injured by reckless use of sympathy, the offending student will be whipped, singly, no more than 7 times across the back. I wondered what book Master Lauren was reciting from.
Number of lashes sought?
Hem looked at the other master's faces, realizing the tide had turned against him.
My foot is blistered halfway to my knee, he gritted. 3 lashes!
The Chancellor cleared his throat. Does any master oppose this action?
Aye!
Elxadal and Kilvin said together. Who wishes to suspend the discipline? Vote by show of hands. Elxadal, Kilvin, and Arwill raised their hands at once, followed by the Chancellor. Mandrag kept his hand down, as did Lauren, Brandur, and Hem. Elodin grinned at me cheerily, but did not raise his hand. I kicked myself for my recent trip to the archives and the bad impression it made on Lauren. If not for that, he might have tipped things in my favor.
4.5 in favor of suspending punishment, the Chancellor said after a pause.
The discipline stands. 3 lashes to be served tomorrow, the 3rd of Echis at noon.
As I was deep into the heart of stone, all I felt was a slight analytical curiosity about what it would be like to be publicly whipped. All the masters showed signs of preparing to stand and leave, but before things could be called to a close, I spoke up.
Chancellor.
He took a deep breath and let it out in a gush.
Yes.
During my admission, you said that my admittance to the Arcanum was granted, contingent upon proof that I had mastered the basic principles of sympathy. I quoted him nearly word for word. Does this constitute proof? Both Hem and the Chancellor opened their mouths to say something. Hem was louder.
Look here, you little cocker!
Hem! The Chancellor snapped. Then he turned to me. I am afraid proof of mastery requires more than a simple sympathetic binding.
A double binding!
Kilvin corrected gruffly. Elodin spoke, seeming to startle everyone at the table.
I can think of students currently enrolled in the Arcanum who would be hard-pressed to complete a double binding, let alone draw enough heat to blister a man's foot to the knee.
I had forgotten how Elodin's light voice moved through the deep places in your chest when he spoke. He smiled happily at me again. There was a moment of quiet reflection.
True enough, admitted Elxadal, giving me a close look.
The Chancellor looked down at the empty table for a minute. Then he shrugged, looked up, and gave a surprisingly jaunty smile.
All in favor of admitting first-term student Kvolth's reckless use of sympathy as proof of mastery of the basic principles of sympathy, vote by show of hands.
Kilvin and Elxadal raised their hands together. Arwill added his a moment later. Elodin waved. After a pause, the Chancellor raised his hand as well, saying,
5.5 in favor of Kvolth's admission to the Arcanum. Motion passed. Meeting dismissed.
Talu shelter us, fools and children all.
He said the last very softly as he rested his forehead against the heel of his hand. Hem stormed out of the room with Brandur in tow. Once they were through the door, I heard Brandur ask,
Weren't you wearing a gram?
No, I wasn't, Hem snapped. And don't take that tone with me, as if this were my fault. You might as well blame someone stabbed in an alley for not wearing armor.
We should all take precautions, Brander said placatingly. You know as well as...
Their voices were cut off with the sound of a door closing. Kilvin stood and shrugged his shoulders, stretching. Looking over to where I stood, he scratched his bushy beard with both hands, a thoughtful look on his face, then strode over to where I stood.
"Do you have your sigildry yet, Ilir Kvoth?"
I looked at him blankly. "Do you mean runes, sir?" "I'm afraid not." Kilvin ran his hands through his beard thoughtfully.
"Do not bother with the basic artificing class you have signed for. Instead, you will come to my workroom tomorrow, noon."
"I'm afraid I have another appointment at noon, Master Kilvin."
Yes.
He frowned.
"First bell, then."
"I'm afraid the boy will be having an appointment with my folk shortly after the whipping, Kilvin," Arwill said with a glimmer of amusement in his eyes. "Have someone bring you to the medica afterwards, son. We'll stitch you back together." "Thank you, sir." Arwill nodded and made his way out of the room. Kilvin watched him go, then turned to look at me.
"My workshop. Day after tomorrow. Noon."
The tone of his voice implied that it wasn't really a question. "I would be honored, Master Kilvin." He grunted in response and left with Alxadal. That left me alone with the still-seated Chancellor. We stared at each other while the sound of footsteps faded in the hallway. I brought myself back up out of the heart of stone and felt a tangle of anticipation and fear at everything that had just happened. "I'm sorry to be so much trouble so soon, sir," I offered hesitantly.
"Oh?"
he said, his expression considerably less stern now that we were alone. "How long had you intended to wait?" "At least a span, sir." My brush with disaster had left me feeling giddy with relief. I felt an irrepressible grin bubble onto my face. "At least a span," he muttered. The Chancellor put his face into his hands and rubbed, then looked up and surprised me with a wry smile. I realized he wasn't particularly old when his face wasn't locked in a stern expression. Probably only on the far side of 40. "You don't look like someone who knows he's going to be whipped tomorrow," he observed. I pushed the thought aside. "I imagine I'll heal, sir." He gave me an odd look. It took me a while to recognize it as the one I'd grown accustomed to in the troop. He opened his mouth to speak, but I jumped on the words before he could say them. "I'm not as young as I look, sir. I know it. I just wish other people knew it, too."
"I imagine they will before too long."
He gave me a long look before pushing himself up from the table. He held out a hand.
"Welcome to the Arcanum."
I shook his hand solemnly, and we parted ways. I worked my way outside and was surprised to see that it was full night. I breathed in a lungful of sweet spring air and felt my grin resurface. Then someone touched me on the shoulder. I jumped fully 2 feet into the air and narrowly avoided falling on Simon in the howling, scratching, biting blur that had been my only method of defense in Tarbian. He took a step back, startled by the expression on my face. I tried to slow my pounding heart.
"Simon, I'm sorry, I'm just... Try to make a little noise around me. I startle easily."
"Me too," he murmured shakily, wiping a hand across his forehead. "I can't really blame you, though. Riding the horns will do that to the best of us. How did things go?"
"I'm to be whipped and admitted to the Arcanum."
He looked at me curiously, trying to see if I was making a joke.
"I'm sorry. Congratulations."
He made a shy smile at me.
"Do I buy you a bandage or a beer?"
I smiled back.
"Both."
By the time I got back to the fourth floor of the Mews, rumor of my non-expulsion and admission into the Arcanum had spread ahead of me. I was greeted by a smattering of applause from my bunkmates. Hem was not well-loved. Some of my bunkmates offered odd congratulations, while Basil made a special point of coming forward to shake my hand. I had just climbed up to a sitting position on my bunk and was explaining to Basil the difference between a single whip and a six-tail when the third-floor steward came looking for me. He instructed me to pack up my things, explaining that Arcanum students were located in the West Wing. Everything I owned still fit neatly into my travel sack, so it was no great chore. As the steward led me away, there was a chorus of goodbyes from my fellow first-term students. The West Wing bunks were similar to those I had left behind. It was still rows of narrow beds, but here they weren't stacked too high. Each bed had a small wardrobe and desk in addition to a trunk. Nothing fancy, but definitely a step up. The biggest difference was in the attitudes of my bunkmates. There were scowls and glares, though for the most part I was pointedly ignored. It was a chilly reception, especially in the light of the welcome I had just received from my non-Arcanum bunkmates. It was easy to understand why. Most students attend the university for several terms before being admitted into the Arcanum. Everyone here had worked their way up through the ranks the hard way. I hadn't. Only about three-quarters of the bunks were full. I picked one in the back corner, away from the others. I hung my one extra shirt and my cloak in the wardrobe and put my travel sack in the trunk at the foot of my bed. I lay down and stared at the ceiling. My bunk lay outside the light of the other students' candles and sympathy lamps. I was finally a member of the Arcanum, in some ways exactly where I had always wanted to be.